Welcome, listeners, to Wiggle Room number 13. I think I got the number right this time. It's been a while since I got that number right, I believe. my name is I'm one of your hosts today. I am Dana Longley. I am the Assistant Director for Library Instruction and Information Literacy. I might have got those two things backwards. It's early in the morning. But joining me today is Mark and Carlene. Guys, introduce yourselves.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Carlene. Oops, sorry, Mark.
No, go ahead.
All right, I'm Carlene Huxley, and I'm the instruction coordinator for Jefferson Community College, or SUNY Jefferson, as we're otherwise known.
The power of SUNY. I am Mark McBride. I am the coordinator of library instruction at Buffalo State College.
Okay, and I can't remember if I mentioned, I am at SUNY Empire State College, and we are three SUNY librarians talking today about the NMC Horizon Report, the 2012 Higher Education edition. And just to give a little background here, I brought up the webpage with the information. The annual NMC Horizon Report describes it's a research-oriented effort that seeks to identify and describe emerging technologies likely to have considerable impact on teaching, learning, and creative expression within higher education. So there's a couple things, and this is an annual report, comes out every year, and it's sort of, I think it's a kind of report that's really in our wheelhouse because three of us have an interest, obviously, in teaching and learning, but also in emerging technologies, and this is sort of talks about the confluence of those two things. So there's some interesting things in this newest report. What are your guys' sort of overall impressions, thoughts?
Well, you know, I'm always happy to see this come out. It's like one of those markers that the year is almost official. When I see the Horizon Report, then I know, oh wow, we're actually into another year. I was really impressed. I always am with the Horizon Report. I think that they that the people who were involved with the project always seemed to be really thoughtful with their analysis, and you know, they just don't throw something out there and just for the sake of getting something to print. And I'm also really impressed by the large number of people that are involved with it. I'm always impressed when a large group of people can actually produce something, because you know, working in smaller groups can be a real challenge. So when you're working in a large group and you can actually put together a report like this annually, it's just impressive to me. But you know, along those lines, I mean, there was a few things that stood out to me, and I imagine we'll get to them today during the podcast. But the one thing that always seems to be showing up is gaming, and you know, and I, you know, I'm not a gamer per se, but I can really see the value of gaming in education. I know there's just not much going on in my campus, and it would be really nice if there was more of it, because I think there's just a real interesting blend of active learning that can take place with gaming. So I'd like to you know, find really good examples of that somewhere.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm a big time gamer myself, and so I always like to, you know, to me that was the one that really, you know, holds the most interest to me as far as sort of the six trends that they talk about in this year's report. And, you know, I think, you know, the reality is that gaming and education is a great potential idea that hasn't yet seen, you know, real fruition in any way, just because the threshold for designing an engaging and educational game has not, it's very hard to do. You know, we're just seeing it sort of at the elementary school type of level, where, you know, games at that, you know, very lower sort of cognitive level are arising. But, you know, at the higher education level, building that in takes a lot of money and a lot of effort to do it right. Because, you know, people, when you get to the college level, they're used to such high-quality gaming experiences outside of education that to duplicate that in the educational experience, I think, takes a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the other problem, though, is perhaps the stigma that's still involved in some areas of higher education when it comes to the idea of incorporating gaming into education on a higher level. You know, I think there's still a lot of people out there that regrettably refuse to kind of see the benefit of it and still have a tendency to just think of gaming as something that could not possibly potentially be of value when it comes to you know, higher academic education and stuff, which is why, you know, like Mark, I would really like to see good, successful examples of this, because that's what's going to, you know, sell people on your own campus, you know, with trying to persuade them to do it as well.
And, you know, I think perhaps maybe we're just approaching the point technologically with the ability to, for example, create mobile apps, and sort of point-click method without having, you know, true programming skills, where that's sort of starting to become a potential. So that, you know, even librarians with no programming skills could come up with some sort of crude, you know, mobile app that, you know, involves some sort of gaming, whether it's social gaming or RPG elements, or even just like a point-and-click adventure type of thing,
right?
That incorporates, you know, whatever concepts you want to teach.
Yeah, I think it's hard. I mean, I know here, I think the predominant opinion on that is just simply that gaming equals entertainment, and entertainment couldn't possibly, you know, be education. You know, there's like little things that we could try to do. It's, I don't even remember what it's called, but those little, you know, talking avatars that they have. And
Animoto?
Yeah, Animoto, and, you know, creating little videos like that that we can put into our libguides. You know, that's pretty much the extent of what's, you know, what's been done on our campus that I know of.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, you know, it's just, you know, each generation, I think gaming has become more and more part of our of the lives of those generations. So, you know, as older members retire and newer members of the institution come in, my guess is that the ability to integrate, you know, gaming elements into the curriculum will grow.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, you know, we're at a point now where gaming in most of the younger generations is just sort of like a given. It's, you know, part of, you know, granted it's mostly part of the sort of social and entertainment things, but it's crossed the barrier from just being like a niche, you know, nerdy pursuit to being sort of mainstream.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said before, I'm not a gamer per se. You know, when I was younger, I mean, dating myself a little bit, but I remember like the Atari consoles came out and then television and then, you know, and I mean, to me, that was like, you know, that was the most amazing thing in the world. But I remember going to visit my my nephew, and I was reading Mark Prinsky's book. I forget the one where he, Digital Natives book that he had published. And I was interested in Call of Duty, and I had my little nephew play Call of Duty with me, and I just kept shooting a wall because I couldn't figure out how to turn or anything like that. And he's like flying through the entire thing and like protecting his big dumb uncle. And you know, after we played for a little while, he says, "Are you done?" I said, "Yeah, I'm done." I was like jamming him up. You know, but what was really cool about this Call of Duty is that him and his friends will get online, and they'll have their headsets, and they'll just sit there and they'll talk to each other, and it drives my sister and her husband nuts. But I've listened to their conversations, and they talk about a lot more than just the game. You know, it's almost like the game is just kind of like that. It's like the bridge. You know, instead of getting together at the local soda shop or whatever, they're getting together in Call of Duty. And, you know, they're talking about girls, they're talking about their classes, you know, they're talking about teachers they like and some that they dislike. I mean, they're talking about the whole thing. So there's a social aspect to it that I think a lot of people are missing. And I think, and to me, social is just an enormous part of education right now. I mean, I think it always has been, because collaboration moving forward, it's just the key. And I think these games can usher that in, because, you know, you give everybody a common ground. You give everybody a platform that they're familiar with or they're comfortable with, you know, other than just a traditional classroom. And you know, you see the creative juices fly.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, one of the things that, you know, I think is important is that, like, you know, for example, there's examples even in-game where collaboration and, you know, group strategic thinking arises.
Yeah.
You know, there's been studies of World of Warcraft and other types of social MMO, you know, massively multiplayer online games where, you know, high schoolers and even, you know, all kinds of players are doing massive amounts of work to play this game collaboratively, coming up with all sorts of mathematical formulas to try and figure out, you know, how to beat these big bosses and things like that. And that's, you know, nothing to do with formal education. They've done this on themselves. And I think what, you know, more and more educational people are thinking is we can tap into that. And I don't think it's been done in any regular way yet, but if you can tap into that potential where students are driven by the game to do that sort of thing, that has a huge potential.
Yeah.
You know, not only just for, like, you know, whatever specific learning goals are involved in whatever game you come up with, but also the ideas of, you know, enhancing collaborative skills, enhancing sort of long-term thinking, strategic thinking, those types of things.
Yeah, and I think there's even been studies in, and I see this more and more now with the apps that my son downloads onto my iPad all the time now, driving me crazy. you know, I seem to remember reading a couple of articles that talked about the benefit of learning through story and how gaming could be could provide that type of thing for students, for kids, for everybody. It's sort of learning and sharing stories through the game and how kind of important, you know, that is for your creativity and how it builds on your creativity. I mean, I'm not a big, like, gamer, like World of Warcraft stuff, but I did do, and I'm going to out myself again here, but I did do a little bit of D&D when I was in college. So, you know, I've done a lot of the role playing, like the around the table type of stuff. And that was something that I can remember really helping my creative flow when it came to being able to write papers, because I was going to grad school at the time. And, you know, Friday nights we would get together and we'd play D&D or, you know, some other role playing game. And we would have to create a character and then create a backstory for the character. And then there would be a story that my husband, the DM, would be creating. And, you know, so everything was like a story. And there was just, you know, having to be a part of that and having to create that and help be like a collaborative element in creating that story, I think was probably more beneficial for my creativity than anything I'd ever done in high school. You know, when it came to English classes, per se, or anything like that.
And maybe it plays into sort of the... I lost my train of thought there. It plays into the idea of motivation. In other words, when there's a story that's of interest to someone that you have a role in having an effect on, that's much more conducive to learning and to effort put into the learning than, you know, your sort of traditional lecture where you're just receiving a bunch of information that doesn't necessarily have a much impact on your thought processes are, or where, you know, your everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or, yeah, no impact at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. I totally agree with that. And is, you know, and I remember I played D&D when I was a kid too. And, when it was really interesting, my mother had, was kind of, you know, she didn't understand it at all, but, she started, understanding what I had been doing. And, she actually conned me into reading Ivanhoe because of my affinity for D&D. So, she said, this is about knights. And so I read Ivanhoe because I played D&D. So
there you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I would never would have read it otherwise.
So one of the things that I envisioned, that one of the things that's been on my sort of plate to, hopefully at some point make time for, is developing, even if it's just a simple, like, text-based choose-your-own adventure type of thing that's based on information literacy concepts. So, I mean, there's tools out there right now where you can easily create a text-based sort of branching adventure. So you set it in some genre milieu where the person makes choices. And, you know, so you could set it, you know, for example, in... you know, make a person like a private investigator, and they're investigating something that has to do with document evaluation, or you can even make it like CSI based or something like that. But it, you know, you can bring in sort of basic information literacy skills like information evaluation and those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen anything compelling yet in that area, and it seems like such a cool way to go with it. I wish I had the time to and you know, some more basic programming skills to be able to put something like that together easily. But I hope to pursue that more going forward, something like that. And then, you know, obviously, if you could bring in visual or multimedia elements, that it makes it even more compelling.
Yeah. You know, and something else that popped up in the Horizon Report that always captivates me and always gets my attention was the digital media literacy, I guess, concern that it's there's agreement that it's a very important, you know, component, there needs to be training and whatnot, for teachers,
right,
and for professors, and that there is nothing out there yet, it's very little, and, you know, in training people to be literate where digital media is concerned is really important. So, I wonder if, like, something like, you know, the lack of gaming and education has something to do with the lack of real understanding of digital media and its real potential and what you need to know and the skills you need to have in order to, you know, to play in this world gone digital.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. But I wonder if there's like a lot of, there's not a lot, but, you know, I can think of a couple of reasons why that's happening. You know, first of all, if we take our campus, for example, you know, we're in a remote North Country area. We're all suffering from budget problems right now. Being able to send teachers to an adequate training or a some sort of conference where they could really learn about this stuff. First of all, it costs money that many of the departments don't actually have right now. So the responsibility rests on them to do it on their own, which, you know, I think librarians tend to be very good about this because we're really into it. But I think, you know, for teachers, their schedules and their workload is such that, you know, they're struggling to just get their assignments done or,
sure,
you know, create assignments for their students every day. I mean, at least on my campus, we are so short-staffed in every department right now that every time I have an instruction class, you know, even if it's just with English or whatever, teachers are coming in telling me how exhausted they are and how over, you know, they've got such a huge workload, and then there's this committee and that committee, and you know, I can just look at them and I'm like, you know, I can completely understand why you're struggling to keep up with this stuff, you know. And as librarians, we could really play a good role here because we can provide them with that training kind of easily during the lunch hour, or, you know, do like the little small things like sending out articles to people in the English department or, you know, whatever about gaming, you know, as a campus-wide email, or, you know, there's these little small things, but whether or not they're actually going to read it and retain it and actually have time to figure out a way to apply it, you know, to their teaching, you know, that to me is still very questionable. So I think there's a lot of things that play into that, and I think it is a huge problem, and I don't really know how to solve it without just saying, dude, we need more money, you know, or something,
yeah.
Or we need more teachers or something like that. So we can have the, you know, the resources in order to be able to do it.
That's a very good point. I mean, you know, just start having that institutional wide support for that type of innovation takes a lot of money and time and effort. And, we're at a point right now, I think, where you just have some individual outliers who are sort of experimenting with this stuff, but there's not a whole lot going on as far as, like, institutional-wide, curriculum-based type of stuff yet.
Right. And what's interesting is that the Horizon Report did also say that those institutional barriers were still presenting a huge problem when it came to, you know, integrating immersion technologies on campuses too. So, I mean, it's not just us that see that. That's something that was in the report as well. I just now noticed it because I have it in front of me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's probably the biggest issue right there is that, one, teachers have no time for the training, and then, institutions that are training teachers and are training, faculty, they're not providing the training in their curriculum. So it's almost like it's a double-edged sword where you have, you know, the teachers are coming out of, you know, they're finishing up their college work and they're going off into the classroom, but they haven't had any of that formal training on educational technology. And then you have the professors who are teaching them here who, and what I mean by here is just any institution, that don't have it into their curriculum because they're too busy to bring it into their curriculum because they're just trying to keep up with just getting their classes taught and, you know, being short staffed and the ample amount of service that is required from faculty nowadays. It's and I like the idea of incorporating the library into that, but, you know, where do the libraries fit into it? I know both of you are working in this probably similar situation where I am, where, you know, if you had a couple more people on staff, you could probably get a heck of a lot more done and clear off the desk so you can work on more, work on projects and whatnot that maybe lend itself to this digital media literacy.
Yeah. What do you guys think of, like, you know, one of the other ones that stuck out to me, and Mark, you've talked about this in the past, is sort of the learning analytics section there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm jazzed about learning analytics. I can't wait to see how it all plays out. You know, I think the best thing about the Horizon Report this time around, because, you know, now that we're talking about it, I'm probably thinking about it more than I did before this, before the podcast, was that I'm starting to really get a good handle on what learning analytics really is. You know, I had a small grasp on it, but now I'm starting to really see the potential for learning analytics in everything that we do.
So, I mean, just like, because my understanding of it is surface level probably at best, but it's basically, my understanding is like sort of like real time, ongoing assessment in a way, right?
Yeah. And it would be all based on the individual learner. So, yeah. In the past, assessment has been more of an institutional level. just to get data out to people and say, hey, look, this is what we're doing. Well, you know, this goes along the line of a meaningful assessment where it's case by case where, and you can actually, you know, curtail your teaching to the learners in your classroom.
It talks about, you know, for example, you know, identifying sort of students preemptively who might be at risk and then providing, you know, the necessary support to make sure that they get them back, you know, out of that at-risk area. So, and one of the things that it talks about is, like, you know, developing tools so that, like, you know, if you have a learning management system that's tied into a lot of things, you gather data from all that and you can see, all right, you know, this student hasn't participated, you know, together with their grades, hasn't participated in 2 weeks. You know, you can identify that, and then you could bring in the proper support to make sure that they're not going to fail out. They're not, you know, that they're get reengaged with the material, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and in the way I, you know, I kind of envision it, I think you're starting to see it now, is that publishers are starting to get involved, like Pearson, McGraw-Hill, and whatnot. And, you know, the future of the textbook is going to be, you know, it's almost going to take over for the learning management system, or be work in conjunction with the learning management system, where everything will be tied in together, or they're going to at least try to tie everything in together.
That's where the insidious part of this sort of comes in.
Yeah,
or the
exactly.
Insidious part of, like, you know, you're talking about, you know, huge barriers of, you know, information privacy,
yeah.
Privacy and sort of information security type of things. Because, I mean, you know, one of the things that struck out to me is that, you know, it talks about, when they first mentioned it, talking about, you know, monitoring social media activities and things like that. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
I don't think students are going to go for that.
Yeah, well, I don't think students are going to go for it. And it, you know, I would doubt that many faculty would go for it either.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I think that will, you know, I hope that gets kind of pushed to the side, because that, you know, you know, when we start talking about monitoring people's behavior, it just has a, you know, an air of like get smart behind it. You know what I mean? And it, I don't know. Just when I hear that, I just get a knot in my tummy.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, like a lot of things, you got to find that balance of, because, you know, obviously to make any sort of assessment, you need data about what people are doing that you're trying to assess, but, you know, have to find that balance between getting the right amount of data and not collecting too much data, and making sure that the people, you know, the data that you're collecting, the people that you're collecting on is comfortable with that or is willing to share that data.
Right.
And that, you know, to me, like it says, you know, time to adoption, 2 to 3 years. I'm not sure about that. I think there's probably some larger issues that probably need to be worked out before that, so that model comes into play in any meaningful way. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one person who I think has a really good take on that is George Siemens. If you've ever read George Siemens on What is Learning Analytics, you know, he is a really good article, and he is a really thoughtful analysis of what learning analytics could be. I really enjoy the way he kind of outlines everything and the way he envisions it, because it takes that component of just some corporate entity monitoring a student activity and brings it back down into the individual learner model, which I think, you know, that if we're going to do learning analytics, we have to think about how this supports the individual and not so much how companies can make a lot of money off of it. Because, you know,
even how educational institutions could use it to maintain, you know, do retention and recruitment. You don't want to make that into something that, you know, profits the institution rather than the individual learner.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean that's the goal. We'll see how it all plays out. But I agree with you too, that 2 to 3 year window, I think they're you know, I think they're being a little bit generous with that time frame.
So on us, you know, what other elements of the report stuck out at you guys? I mean, I think, you know, two of the things are like sort of, you know, sort of already here, you know, the sort of tablet computing and the, what was the other one? I'm blanking out.
Well, the one thing that popped out was the new modes of scholarship. And I don't know if you read about this, about how, you know, libraries, you know, they have to, they're feeling pressure right now because, you know, to get content, you don't necessarily need to be connecting through the library. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I know a lot of the professors on this campus and a lot of the students, you know, they bypass using a lot of the content in the library and use things like Google Scholar, and I know some of our history professors are starting to use HathiTrust. It's just interesting about what's happening with just with scholarship and university collections.
I see that sort of as like, you know, the sort of slow dying of traditional publishing methods. Because, I mean, I just look at my own, the way I myself keep up with my own profession. And, you know, the amount of scholarly reading that I do is way less than it used to be because I can get a lot of that information through more informal means, blogs.
Absolutely.
And certainly someone in that knowledge creation cycle has done some of that scholarly reading and creating, but I haven't. And so, I mean, I'm confident in my ability at this point where even, you know, if I were not attached to an academic institution where I actually had access to all these materials, that I could still keep up with a lot of what's going on. Without having access to the sort of primary scholarly material, at least in librarianship. In some other fields, it's probably a lot different.
I think it's going to be interesting to see, too, how the change in scholarly publishing is going to be changing the way we're teaching people information literacy. And I'm not sure that we're quite as on top of that yet. You know, I'm still teaching a lot of the stuff that are in my classes. It's probably the same that it was 3 years ago, and things are different than they were 3 years ago. And I think sometimes I forget that I need to, you know, reevaluate how I'm helping them to interpret that sort of information environment in the scholarly academic fields. I mean, just when it comes down to that traditional way of helping them to identify what's a scholarly article, you know, the one that was just always so easy for me when I was in college was, oh, well, you know, the journals look more like books. And, and of course, now you have all of these different nursing journals that look just like a trade journal or a regular magazine. And the articles in them are only 2-3 pages long, but they're still considered apparently a scholarly. It says in there that they are a peer-reviewed scholarly article. You know, it has, like an abbreviated version of that whole introduction method and, you know, conclusion or whatever, but it's just a lot harder for students to physically identify it the way that they were before. And I keep forgetting about that when I'm in my classes and still just relying on the same spiel that I do over and over again. So,
yeah. As someone who works in the, you know, primarily online environment myself, I mean, that's doubly the case where that, you know, identifying peer-reviewed or scholarly, even when you have some of the tools that these databases provide for helping you identify that, makes it very hard. And, you know, what I continually run up against is student perceptions of, you know, or student expectations of what they're willing to do and the realities, for example, of scholarly materials that, you know, while there are some examples, like you cited in the nursing stuff, of, you know, sort of short, semi-scholarly materials, in most cases, I mean, I'm just continually running up against this, where students, you know, just say to me, I need to find something peer-reviewed or scholarly, but I want to find it quick, and I need it to be, like, you know, short and easy to read. And it's like, okay, well,
And not boring.
You can adjust your reality.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's like part of the downside of sort of social networking and open content and blogs and all these sorts of things, that they're great for taking this source technical material and putting it into sort of readable terms. But in that process, some of the, you know, necessary information to make the evaluation of the veracity of that information is lost.
Right.
Does that make sense? And so that complicates the whole idea of you know, going back to your original point, Carlene, of like, you know, how you teach evaluation in that kind of environment.
Yeah, you know, what was interesting was I was teaching a class, an education class, I think about a year ago, and I remember a student was looking for work by a certain author because she'd been researching for a while and she hadn't found anybody, and I forget what the topic was. It could have been like game-based learning. I mean, it was something rather new, maybe like flipped classroom or something along those lines. But anyway, she was looking for a scholarship on it, and she couldn't find it because it was so new. So she found this one author, and she dug and dug and dug, and she couldn't find anything. And we were working in the classroom together, and she was getting really frustrated. So I stopped, and I thought, okay, what would you do if this was you, what you were looking for? You know, what would you do? And the first place I went was Twitter. And we found the guy on Twitter. And she started following him and found out that he was posting all sorts of content on Twitter. And she, that really informed her scholarship. And that's how she ended up connecting with the content. She found one particular author one particular professional who was really out in front of a lot of other people. And before the scholarship really came out into the standard academic published journal, you know, this professor out in California was just like posting papers and blog posts that he had stumbled on and whatnot. And she was just kind of lurking and getting involved with the content and really getting involved in the conversation. And she ended up making contact with this person and having an interview with them, and that's how she finished her paper. And she gave me a copy of it. It was absolutely fantastic.
Wow.
Just can't remember what it was on.
I mean, that's a great story. And it sort of feeds into, like, you know, sort of the things I'm looking at here, sort of like, you know, digital media literacy, but also institutional barriers. I mean, one of the things that I encounter is, like, well, the instructions for an assignment or a student approach me and say, oh, I found this resource, it's really good, but, you know, the instructions say I need to find a peer-reviewed scholarly material only. And it's like, well, you know, God, we need to, in some ways, you know, faculty need to adjust things as well, the way they design assignments.
Yeah, I was just about to say that, too. I mean, I get a lot of teachers who cringe when I tell students, you know, if you're, you know, you could use reference books to try to help you get some background information on, you know, your subject or whatever, or you can do a Google search. And if there's a Wikipedia entry that comes up, then you can kind of help develop your knowledge of it that way, or at least pick up a couple of keywords that you might be able to use. And, you know, I always tell them, you know, don't cite it or anything like that, because, you know, that there's this feeling that they shouldn't, you know, that they shouldn't use it, which usually that's what I tell them too, is not to cite it. But then I always get the teacher who's usually like busy grading papers in the, you know, during my instruction. The minute I mention Wikipedia, they look up at me and give me this look like, what the heck are you telling my students to do now? You know? And,
yeah.
And when really what I'm trying to do is present the reality that I know that they're probably going to end up on Wikipedia at some point, if not for this particular assignment, they're going to end up there somewhere else, and I need to tell them how to utilize it, you know, the best way that we think they should, you know, using the sources at the end as cookie crumbs and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, it is. I'm up against that all the time, that I feel I have a very narrow field of where I can tread with mentioning, you know, alternative things that go outside of this world of library databases. And I that kind of worries me, because again, it goes back to that whole thing of, well, I have to work with the faculty who unfortunately probably very few of them, maybe like, I don't know, 15% of them actually even understand or even read blogs on a regular basis. Or maybe they read them, but they don't even know that they are a blog. You know, so we're still dealing with that level on my campus. And it's just simply the not having the knowledge that is probably presenting that barrier. And so, yeah, we're kind of back to that same problem that we had previously of them just not having the training for us to be able to, you know, work with them and be able to improve that in some way.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, I faced that same thing. In fact, I actually had a rather lively debate with a professor in class about Wikipedia. And
yeah.
and he was, like, adamant that I never teach his class again because I even mentioned Wikipedia. And, we kind of talked. I mean, we can still be collegial to one another. But when I asked him if he'd ever been on Wikipedia, and he said no. And I said, if you've never been there, how can you possibly have a authoritative critique of the environment? He says, well, because I know scholarship. And at that point, I thought, some of the more, open-minded educators out there, we tend to be some of the most conservative-minded human beings in the entire world as well. But the point I was trying to make, was if I'm a young PhD student and I'm going through the process of getting my PhD, and I'm at, traditional college XYZ, and, I get all the way to the point of writing my dissertation. I've been pigeonholed into maybe two or three journals that my advisor really likes. And those are the two or three journals that I use to create my body of work. And, the entire thing is, how are we going to be able to train teachers if they're coming through this, this funnel of higher education, and when the people that that are giving them instruction and the people who are being mentors to them are so far off the beaten path and staying with the traditional levels of scholarship. I mean, and the expectations of having faculty that that bring digital media literacy into scholarship is it just makes that uphill climb even a little steeper.
I think that'll come in time, just as newer generations get into those positions. To me, the biggest disconnect is between sort of faculty expectations and student skill levels as far as being able to deal with scholarly materials, sort of critical reading skills. These sort of gray areas that come in between, while faculty either assume that someone else is teaching students how to do it, or they assume that the librarians can do it. For undergraduates, this is especially a problem, is that you see, go out and, find 3 to 5 scholarly peer-reviewed articles on this, basic topic of, abortion, write a 3 to 5 page paper on it. And, students at that point, when they're just starting their career, have no idea what peer-reviewed materials is, let alone how to read it critically and synthesize information from it without just sort of parroting, just thinking, all right, here's some snippets from this article and I'm going to take some quotations from this one and cobble it together and just sort of, restate what they've said. And I think there's a big disconnect in there in being able to take that and put it into students being able to take that material and then critically read it and then create their own ideas from it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, it's going way beyond this report, which is more on the technology side of it. But I think that's an important element when we talk about any sort of emerging technologies, that unless you have those basic digital and information literacy skills, it doesn't matter what technologies are out there. They might not be as effective as we want if we don't address those basic skills better.
Yeah, I mean, I think we, you know, I mean, this is getting into a larger conversation about just education in this country in general. I mean, you know, the K-12 environment, I mean, it just seems that, like, teachers now are just, it's almost like they're doing factory work. And, I mean, and I'm not bashing teachers for that. Trust me on that. It's just that, you know, you got to do this. You got to get all these tests. Here comes a standardized test. You know, my daughter is about to start kindergarten, and she actually has to take a test. And it's like, you got to be kidding me. My daughter's going to be taking a test. She's going into kindergarten? You know, give me a break. You know, I mean, what the heck do you want her to know? You know, I mean, for a kindergartner. You know, it's just the expectations on you know, every time a politician says something like academic standards, I cringe, because yeah. You know what that means. That's another round of standardized tests about to hit the landscape.
Accountability is another thing that's used big in that. And it's like that's another huge disconnect between that and, like, you know, the ability of us to develop good assessment. You know, assessment in so many areas just aren't well tested. That's right. The only assessment we know.
Yeah. And yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I respect a lot of my faculty colleagues, but I think that they don't realize just how fortunate they were to go through the educational pipeline when they did go through it, because there was time to learn the 50, you know, the capitals of the 50 states. There was time to understand the geography of the world. If it's not plugged into a standardized test, guess what? Johnny's not going to learn it. You know, we're more interested in him knowing, you know, the whatever, you know, Pearson or whoever is developing the standardized test determines for them to learn. So, you know, I think there's a gap. I mean, I understand that misunderstanding what expectations on students are, but I think the expectations should, you know, be on the students, yes, but you know what? We should have expectations on ourselves as a society. You know, I'm getting on my soapbox, so I'll get off real quick. But we really need to take a deep breath and really think for a second what the hell we want to do with education in this country.
Yeah, well, that's a huge issue that, you know, way smarter minds than us have failed to come up with reasonable solutions.
Well, I think that's the problem. I think what we're doing is, you know, we're expecting the smarter minds to come up with a solution, but I don't think that's it. I think it's going to be parents. I think it's going to be mothers and fathers who are going to have to come up with a solution.
And I can tell you, too, I mean, Mark, you have one going into kindergarten. I have one who is in kindergarten, and I volunteer there every Tuesday morning for 2 hours because she needs help. And I'm not there, like, you know, cutting out shapes for her. I'm there actually doing, you know, teaching, like, because she has so many things that she has to make sure that they know how to do.
Yeah.
She basically has, like, 3 or 4 different stations in the room of things that are going on at the same time. So I'm doing something about reading on one side, and then we've got another volunteer doing, you know, something about math on the other side, and then she's doing the other activity somewhere. She leaves them alone, and then she has to do some sort of other evaluation with a kid over here. And I mean, it's just insane the amount of work that this teacher has to do. And I've never actually spoken to her. I mean, I'm sure part of this is probably just the way that she teaches. But it just, you know, I can see from all of the stuff that my son brings home during the week, it's a folder just stuffed full of stuff. And, you know, I just don't remember learning that much when I was in kindergarten, you know?
In kindergarten, I was still wet in my pants, you know?
Well, yeah, you know.
I'm still trying to figure that angle out.
Yeah, I was just kind of surprised. You know, I think it's wonderful. You know, he's reading really well and all this stuff. And I'm like, hey, you know, he's a librarian's kid. He's got to be able to read. So that's wonderful. But at the same time, there's just this, you know, I just feel like those kids are just like they're overstimulated. You know, they've got all this stuff going on at the same time. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure what things are going to be like for him when he starts to get into, you know, the middle school, high school years. And, you know, just I try to keep predicting it. And then, of course, with the whole standardized testing thing, and as a parent, I can tell you, and probably, Mark, you can relate to this as well, you know, I do feel a little helpless at times because, you know, as someone who is involved in education in some sense, you see this kind of thing happening. And like you, I sort of feel that there isn't enough movement from the parents in this. We just sort of drop them off at the school, and we assume that because it's a public school and the government is in charge of it or whatever, that their kids are going to be, you know, they're going to be fine. And when you're actually in that classroom and you're seeing what's going on, you know, not that there's anything wrong technically with what she does. I just know that I just have this sense that this is, that there's something better, that we could be doing something to improve that. So
and
that was my soapbox.
That goes all back to the institutional support and money and, you know, all the types of things that, you know, feed into the larger educational issues.
Yeah.
Just to sort of, you know, since we're coming up, we're coming back on an hour here to bring it back to the report. One
good segue,
you know,
by the way, Dana.
I'm sorry?
That was a great segue.
Let's cut you guys off from Xbox. You're done. No.
I got it from here.
Oh, that was a huge digress there.
No. I think these are important things to discuss because, I mean, just like when I was talking about, you know, sort of the basic, you know, sort of information literacy things that are sort of lost when you talk about, you know, technology. I mean, you know, your guys digs even deeper in that. And we have to talk about the whole educational cycle as well. And I think, you know, one of the problems I have with, like, this type of report in general is that one of the things it's easy, I think, to gather from this, if you just sort of skim it, is that you just say, oh, all this technology is great, and it's going to solve all our educational problems. And, you know, on the other side, you know, this report, if you do read it carefully, does, as you guys have mentioned, talk about the obstacles and some of the things that need to go into it to support it, like digital media literacy and social networks and new publishing models and those types of things. But if you just like skim, oh, you go here and say, oh, learning analytics, game-based learning, tablets, this is all great stuff. How can I use all this? How can I, you know, use all these tools? So it's easy to get, you know, just like, you know, when we see when we go to a lot of times a technology sort of focused conference where it's like a lot of the focus is on the technology instead of how to use the technology. That can happen with reports like this sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it has before.
Yeah. And it will again.
Yeah.
That's just because it's easier to think about the technology than it is to think about, you know, how to think through, how do you assess the learning of this, you know, using this technology or using this new form of learning, like, you know, game-based learning. How do you assess something like that? Or, you know, there's also issues of haves and have-nots when you talk about things like mobile apps and tablet computing, which are two of the things that are talked about in this. You know, sure, some schools have the money to pass out iPads to all their incoming students. A lot of others do not. And then how do you deal with people with disabilities and, you know, these types of things that, and how do you deal with people like in my instance that are older that, you know, game-based learning doesn't necessarily, you know, is not in their wheelhouse or, you know, tablet computing is a, you know, you were talking about, you know, before we recorded, you were talking about your grandmother and the problem she has with technology and, you know, I'm thinking, well, I have run into so many of my students that have the very same thing. And so, you know, discussions like this, I think, always need to be tempered by those realities. And that's part of the problem is that, you know, these reports say 1 year or less, two or three years, but there's always going to be people left behind.
Yep.
In those things. And that's the thing that'll slow down, I think, some of these timelines, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I was just going to say that, I think I would love to see New York State and this country take a real aggressive broadband initiative, because I think in order to make all this happen, we need to make sure that the you know, that everybody is connected. We have to solve those digital divide issues, and you know, because if we're going to solve any problems, we just have to get everybody as best as we can on the same page. And if we can't get everybody on the same page, we should at least attempt to try to get everybody on the same page.
Yeah, and there are efforts to do those things, I think.
Yep.
It just, you know, just like everything else, it's a matter of money and a down economy and, you know, institutional support and those types of things. So, and
right.
priorities and all that sort of thing. And I didn't mean to be a... I realize now that what I just said is like a completely wet towel on this whole thing. I did not mean for it to be that way. So, I mean, you know, sort of in the closing minutes here, do you guys have any, like, you know, other thoughts on this report or things that we talked about?
Hmm.
The only thing that comes to mind.
The only thing that comes to mind is that the 3Ts conference is less than, what, 2.5 weeks away? What is it? It's a week from Friday. 2 weeks from Friday. So,
yeah, I was going to say, please don't make it a week from Friday.
No. 2 weeks right. from Friday. So, you know, as Dana was talking about this, the actual practical application of technology in the curriculum, you know, the 3Ts is going to talk about it.
Talk about digital literacy, transliteracy, and,
Yep.
For those listeners that have not heard of this conference, go to 3ts.weebly.com, and it's spelled out 3Ts, and you can find out about that, and you can still register to attend that conference, right, Mark?
Yes, registration is still open. We have, let me just check, right now
Although
we have five, we
full.
Have five spots left.
Okay, so you heard that, folks. Once we get this podcast up, you better jump on that if you want to take part in that. And there's also, there's a lot of cool things that are coming up, like CIT and SUNY Law.
WFMU.